From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, May the 11th, 2020, and we have a good full show lined up for you this morning. Elizabeth Hewitt's going to be our first guest. She is reporter and editor with VTDigger.org, and she's going to fill us in on some of what that organization has been covering in recent days. And following that, we're going to be speaking with Elliot Greenblatt. He is with AARP Vermont, and he's going to be talking to us about what some of the current scams are out there, things to watch out for, the telltale signs you might hear over the telephone from some stranger calling you that might indicate to you that, this ain't for real. And we'll be talking with Elliot about all that in the second half hour. And then later on, there's been a lot of chatter lately about broadband internet in Vermont and how its importance has been highlighted as we have moved to remote education. Our school kids are taking classes on computer screens these days, and of course a lot of folks are still working from home and making internet connectivity even more important than it has been all along. And so we're going to be talking in the second hour of today's show with two people who are trying to bring broadband internet to more parts of Vermont. Those are Irv Tome, he's with EC Fiber, and Jeremy Hansen is with CV Fiber. Central Vermont Internet is an organization that's trying to basically take EC Fiber's playbook and bring essentially publicly sponsored internet to a broader swath of especially rural parts of Vermont, where the major carriers have been slow to deploy their services. Anyway, let's get right to it with Elizabeth Hewitt this morning. She's with VTDigger.org and is becoming a regular friend of the Dave Graham Show, and we really like that fact. And Elizabeth, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
It's a great way to start a Monday morning. Hi, Dave.
Absolutely. We were talking a little bit on the phone a while ago, just kind of saying, hey, what should we talk about today? And I think we jointly agreed that a lot of the coverage of VT Digger lately is looking a little bit like all COVID all the time. I know you guys are eager to get into other stuff as well when it arises, but boy, there's just so many angles connected to this COVID-19 pandemic story, and it's going to be around for a while. And so let's talk about some of what is going on there. In fact, you had a really cool roundup this morning where you kind of highlighted what some of the stories are about, and then links to the longer versions of the stories. Let's go through some of this if we could. And the lead here is talking about many Vermonters are following the public health recommendations. There seems to be a high level of cooperation and compliance in the state, unlike some other places where folks are sort of rebelling, or at least some folks are. There's also a fair amount of, I don't know if it's a little bit of a busybody attitude or exactly what's going on here, but some people are not only enforcing these rules for themselves, but trying to do so for others. What are you seeing and hearing out there from VT Digger's vantage point?
Yeah, so we've sort of noticed over the last few weeks, we've been getting a lot of emails from members of the public. There have been messages posted on social media, on Front Porch Forum, that folks are reaching out, letting others know when they see other people in Vermont who aren't following the health guidelines that the state is recommending. This includes, you know, wearing a fabric face covering, a mask, while in public places. This has been recommended by state health officials and also the and federal health officials as well. Other guidelines are, you know, social distancing, maintaining 6 feet between you and others. And so we'd sort of been getting these tips about, there are just notes about people observing maybe groups of people in certain places or people who aren't wearing masks. And so our editor, Colin Mine, started looking into this and why people are reaching out to let us know about this and what sort of makes people want to do that and want to let people know. Some important background here is while the state has recommended that Vermonters wear masks when they go out in public, Governor Scott has really been, he's repeatedly said that he's not willing to, you know, provide more of an enforcement mechanism behind this. So far, really, the state has emphasized education as the way to be encouraging people to follow these guidelines. And, you know, even the Attorney General's office has, they've put out guidelines for enforcement, but they really are focusing their efforts on educating folks and encouraging compliance that way. Similarly, we know, you know, certain local police departments, the Burlington Police Department, they do have some enforcement mechanisms, but they haven't really used them. So it really is, this is the, in terms of supporting these guidelines, it's really much more an education-focused approach that the state has taken, which is, you know, it stands sort of in contrast to a lot of the ways that people are paying attention to what others are doing and sort of alerting others to it. So Colin Calderon, he spoke to a social scientist at UVM, a psychology professor there, and she said that there's this theory, a terror management theory, that that is sort of when humans are confronted with something that they fear, that sort of develop a culture around it, and it's certain standards that we sort of expect people to behave by. And then when you're in that position where you're thinking about your own mortality, you're more likely to derogate people who are not following those guidelines with you. So it's an interesting story to sort of take a look at where we are right now and get a sense of sort of why people might be feeling the way that they're feeling.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if there are any historical parallels here of, you know, mass behaviors like this in previous periods of human history wherein, I mean, we think about in some parts of the world even today, there are certain clothing requirements. I think of in some segments of societies in the Middle East, you know, women are expected to wear burqas or other what in the West would be considered pretty restrictive coverings and so on. And that there's, I think there are actually laws in some places about that. And I'm sure there's a lot of shaming if people don't follow these rules and so on and so forth. One example there, but I mean, in terms of a response to kind of a public emergency and so-and-so isn't following the rules to follow a public emergency or to combat a public emergency, I'm just wondering what would be a prior example of this? I'm sure there are some. I just can't think of what they. Do you have any thoughts there, Elizabeth?
You know, I can't actually think of another one right off the top of my head. I think one thing that we are seeing, like Vermont has, Governor Phil Scott's administration has taken this really emphasis on education approach. There have been more stronger requirements put in place in other parts of the country with regards to things like mask wearing. And in some places, you know, there's been really strong backlash to it. We referenced that there's one city in Oklahoma that had put in place a requirement that people wear masks, and that there were so many reports of threats of violence against, like, employees and stores and stuff within the first few hours that it took effect that the city immediately dialed it back.
I think it underscores
how we're in this really unusual moment, humanity-wide moment, and just sort of looking at the psychological things that are playing out around the world, really.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency also of folks, if you're kind of ordered what to do, your hackles go up. If you are advised what to do, that just presents itself a lot more, I don't know, nicely. And so, you know, Governor Scott may look at this situation and say, no, I'm not going to issue enforcement orders here for people to wear masks. I'm going to tell folks I think it's a good idea. And actually, he models the behavior. He gets up at these press conferences and you see him with a mask on. And, you know, as long as he is, you know, especially when he's not speaking. And I wonder, if there's a little bit of strategizing there in the sense of, I think if he'd come out and he said, everybody, you know, is required to wear a mask and we're going to fine you if you don't or something, you know, the old saying, I'm a Vermonter, I do what I want to, might come into play here more readily.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, it's kind of an interesting, I think, strategic play here, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I mean, I think this might, another story that we had yesterday, our data reporter looked at some new survey data and also some location data that had been collected through cell phones, and saw that Vermont has a really high compliance rate and that the state has, public opinion in the state seems to be that largely backing the way that the steps that the governor and the state has taken in terms of shutdown and supporting the different public health guidelines to be trying to keep folks safe through this crisis.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And then the your VT Digger coverage also. This research finding that Vermonters support this is I think another side of the same coin. Really, the question being, this is definitely a time when the relationship between individual citizens and their government is kind of highlighted, really. And so, and I think it's good journalism to cover kind of both sides of that in terms of what are people thinking and doing out there, and what is the government saying and doing, and how do the two mesh, et cetera. So excellent work covering both sides of this issue. Let's see here. The number of new confirmed coronavirus cases in Vermont increased by 8 over the weekend, bringing the total in the state since the beginning of the outbreak to 927. No new deaths were reported Saturday or Sunday. And this is interesting to me. Is it fair to say that, you know, the curve is officially flattened?
Well, it's definitely been, this is, as Scott administration officials have said, it seems that we are flattening out. You know, clearly there are still new cases that are coming in, as those numbers indicate. And, you know, the administration's public health officials have been clear that, you know, that these public, we aren't really out of the woods yet. These different public health steps that we have to take, or that we've been advised to take, like mask wearing, like keeping distance from others, are still should be followed. But yeah, it does seem that the numbers have been on a downward swing for weeks now. And that the state does seem to have avoided sort of even the best case scenarios that were being predicted early on in this.
Of course, you know, that prompts some folks who've been thinking this whole situation might have been somewhat exaggerated all along to say, see, it really was exaggerated. We were right. And of course, the counter to that is, you know, I've heard some of the public officials at the governor's news conferences, including Commissioner Mark Levine of the health department, saying things like, well, you know, if you come in under the projections, then your strategies have succeeded, basically. Right. And what kind of credence do we give that claim, would you say?
You know, I'm not a public health expert by any means, but I did one thing that I read early on in the outbreak was sort of that if it seems like we overreacted, then we reacted about right. You know, I definitely, certainly there's a lot of discussion about whether the steps have been appropriate. There was a very small gathering of protesters at the State House on Saturday, protesting to reopen the state, saying it's time. It's new. We're on new territory here.
Yeah.
But yeah. But I, it does continue. The state continues to really take really measured approaches. You know, we've seen some reopening of the state recently. The governor has been turning his metaphorical spigot every few weeks. Actually, last week we saw different changes over a few days, and so things are beginning to reopen. And you know, I think certainly this will continue to be. Certainly, we'll be continuing to watch the numbers because that will be a real indicator of how things are going.
Yeah, and whether the various stages of reopening are actually, you know, a good idea or maybe too ambitious or that kind of thing. I mean, and the problem with all this, of course, is that you don't really know in advance. You have to kind of try it, you know, and see how it goes. Everybody's sort of feeling their way forward. But some of the, just to give folks an update, some of the things that have been reopened, we're looking at daycare centers, for instance, and that's a really important one, especially for healthcare workers who have kids. And of course, healthcare workers have been really pressed lately, a lot of them putting in extra hours at work. Outdoor recreation has been, the spigot has been turned more open on that. Golf courses, for instance, one example of outdoor recreation, are being allowed to reopen, and that's got to be a boon to a small industry in Vermont, which is, of course, just getting into its season. So what are we seeing and hearing out there? Are people celebrating, or are they going tiptoe, or what's the deal, Elizabeth?
Well, I know there's been a lot of interest in the golf course question, especially I've gotten a few emails about it myself. There are slow steps. You know, one of the things, among the things that the governor lifted last week was on social restrictions that now he's loosened it to up to 10 people can gather. This opens up the possibility for things like play dates or for families who, you know, maybe haven't seen each other, family members who haven't seen each other in months at this point, to get together. He's advised that, you know, if you're, you can begin to interact with others who, other trusted households who have been following the guidelines as well. These are steps that sort of start to make. They're little steps towards what we consider normal, I guess. But it remains measured. You know, these guidelines again to be keeping distance, to be wearing masks remains in effect. In terms of the childcare centers, there has been childcare available for essential workers through the crisis, but. This latest step is sort of a part of as the rest of the economy opens that, you know, by allowing childcare centers to begin to operate again and summer camps as well are going to be allowed to open, that this is seen as part of the reopening of the economy more broadly because, you know, folks don't want people to be put in the position of, you know, wanting to go back to work but not having access to childcare.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point.
And just so to be clear, that child care centers can reopen as of June 1st. So that's still a few weeks out.
Okay.
Now. Yeah, and we'll be seeing more guidance come out with regards to that and also with summer camps in the next few weeks.
Well, I think these are steps in the direction toward a more open economy, which I think everybody wants. It's something that... this economic shutdown has been very, very tough on people and in so many different ways, financially, of course, but also I just think psychically, you know, people do have their favorite activities. And if you're a golfer and you see springtime coming and, you know, the first daffodils coming up, you're starting to think about getting back out there on the links. And gee whiz, if they're saying, oh, the golf courses are all closed, that is, I think the technical term for that is a bummer.
Right.
So, hey, listeners out there, I meant to mention you are welcome to join our conversation anytime here at WDEV's local call-in number is 244-1777, and the toll-free number is 877-291-8255. 8255 or 291-TALK. And we do appreciate the input we get frequently from folks who are listening to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, and oftentimes call with questions about stuff that I hadn't thought of and maybe our guests hadn't thought of, and add something to the conversation. Let's see about whether Rama can do that this morning. Rama, hello.
Yeah, hey, a couple of things, and this one question you asked this morning, Dave, kind of brought it back, because you had made what I consider an absolutely bad claim that there were cogent arguments to be made on the side of people who felt that we had overreacted to this. And there is nothing in the history of this COVID-19 and the SARS-CoV-2 virus, or whatever it's called, to suggest that we overreacted. I just hope as we go towards this relaxing social restrictions and as people move out and gather around more, even in 10 groups and less, there are some long-term issues that are cropping up that are related to the COVID-19, and we don't know how. And I think folks in particular should be paying attention to the story that's coming out of New York right now about the kids and the toxic shock syndrome. And before we start talking about getting kids in big daycares or getting kids back to school, et cetera, let's make sure we understand what this COVID-19 is, what it does. And let's not underreact, because I don't care what people say. We don't have to all go into a mass die-off for somebody's pocketbook.
Yeah, I think that certainly states your view there pretty well. I mean, I would call that argument cogent as well, Rama. I just I don't mean to be siding with either end here. I'm curious, though, to get your thought about a piece I saw the other day from something called the American Institute for Economic Research, where they looked at a pandemic that occurred back in the late 1960s. The Hong Kong flu, I think, took about 100,000 American lives. It went on for a number of months that I think actually began in late 68 and ended in early 70s. The Woodstock Festival famously took place in the middle of this pandemic. People were not social distancing at the Woodstock Festival. There was very little reaction as far as any shutdowns economically, et cetera. And the United States of America managed to make its way through that period of history. Is there anything to be learned there?
Well, how about let's start by looking at the fact that let's do a comparison between these viruses and the diseases and the after effects of the exposure to the virus that is caused before we try to draw parallels. Because, listen, there's been pandemics before. One pandemic may not bear much of a resemblance to the next pandemic. It doesn't mean a darn thing. People want to bring up all these other things that happen. All I know is everything we know about COVID-19, the disease spreads very easily. The virus that causes it spreads even easier. And we are not only know that people were very disastrously affected. And it's not just old people, by the way. It's everywhere that people were clustered together, whether it was in nursing homes, meatpacking factories, out on military naval vessels or military posts around the world. We know that it's proximity that got this to spread. We know it beyond a shadow of a doubt. So anything that says otherwise is not a cogent argument. We know that it spreads easily. We've seen it. We've got the numbers. There's nothing to say that we should just sit here and say, whew, you know, we got past the worst of this.
I'm not sure we have, so I haven't said that and don't think so. Well, Rama, thank you for the call. I got to move on, but you always are a provocative thinker, and we welcome your participation here. Hey, we do have another caller, Marcia from Barrie. Good morning, Marcia.
Hi, morning, Dave. You're bringing up that study once again about what went on in the late 60s with the Hong Kong flu, and there's somebody who was, and you're wondering why things didn't happen the same. Well, it wasn't the same. I was 21 in 69. Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember the flu being anywhere near this issue. You didn't have people flooding the hospitals. You didn't have anybody dying the way it was. That was the year that I graduated college, and I went to Boston University, and it's a huge school. And we had a huge huge graduation at Nickerson Field, and Senator Ed Brooke was the speaker, and there wasn't any fallout from that. And I went to Woodstock with all those people. No one got sick like that. No one talked about it. There wasn't even a satirical song about the Hong Kong flu. yes, it occurred, but it wasn't anything like this.
Yeah.
So I think you really got to, I don't know where you were. You're old enough.
Yeah, I was in my early teens.
On?
Yeah.
Huh?
I was in my early teens in those days.
Do you remember?
Delivering newspapers, I remember reading occasionally about the Hong Kong flu. But anyway.
Yes, hey, it was.
Yeah.
But it wasn't anything. So these revisionists are bringing up this stuff, and you succumb to it. And
okay.
I wish you would. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the call, Marcia. I appreciate it. And don't be a stranger. Hey, Elizabeth Hewitt, just about 90 seconds to go. Have you run into anybody in state government who talks about that that sort of example of a pandemic response from the late 60s? Or is this just something that for some reason is stuck in my craw?
I'm not familiar with that particularly, but I do think... one thing that comes up, this is a new illness. We're learning more about it all the time. One of the callers mentioned that one thing that is very clear is how transmittable it is. And I would just sort of again underscore that as Governor Scott is taking steps to reopen the government, to reopen different parts of the state, that one of the consistent things they recommend is continue being vigilant about things like washing your hands, keeping distance from others. For folks who are
Elizabeth, I got to go to a break, unfortunately.
But
thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
Let's go to CBS News, bottom of the hour, back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back, and one of the things going on in the course of this COVID-19 crisis has been that scammers are figuring out new ways to get after people and try to separate you from your money. And in some ways, they are using the COVID-19 crisis as a pretext to do exactly that separation of the mark from the money. And here to talk to us about some of that this morning, we have Elliot Greenblatt. He is with AARP Vermont, and he is somebody who follows these scams and the latest developments and techniques and so on, and might have some tips for us about trying to prevent being a target, or prevent at least being somebody who's being targeted succeeds. Separates you from your money. Elliot Greenblatt, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
And tell me what some of the latest is. Are there some new tricks in the trade here?
Well, there aren't really a lot of new tricks, but they're twists on old ones that take advantage of the COVID-19 coronavirus scares. Con artists tend to like chaos, because when you're in a chaotic mode, you don't think clearly, you don't react clearly, and as a result, it makes the environment very conducive to being scammed. You know, for example, there is a drug now that evidently is available in some places, remdesivir. And con artists are making phone calls or sending emails saying it's easy to get that drug, just send money. And people are doing that because they feel there's a chance to save themselves in the event that they contract coronavirus. Mm-hmm. That drug isn't even available at most hospitals. So con artists know that it's in demand. They're going to go after it.
So if you get a call from somebody who says, hey, I can get you some remdesivir, your antenna immediately ought to go up saying
it's not just remdesivir. It's almost anything that promises a cure. Federal Trade Commission has actually gone after about 30 companies that have made claims that they can either cure or ease or relieve the conditions of COVID-19. And mm-hmm. those are totally false, but people are looking for something that will help them out in this situation. And you know, con artists have a term for it that we use as well in the Fraud Watch program, and it's called putting you under the ether. If we can get you to a point where you're excited, anxious, concerned, then you let your guard down and you end up making mistakes.
And so it sounds to me like anybody calls you up and is recommending any drug to combat the coronavirus. Typically, a drug like remdesivir or any one of these fairly esoteric medicines would be available by prescription, right?
Right.
If they were available, I mean.
Doctor.
Yeah. So the real trick there is if you are starting to get convinced, I mean, I would think, here's just one suggestion, but if you're starting to get convinced that maybe there is a drug out there that I ought to be trying here, and that the place to go is your regular primary care physician, assuming you have one, or, you know, go to the urgent care center if you don't and say, hey, I hear that there's this thing out there that might be helpful in my battle against the coronavirus or in my efforts not to get it or whatever the case may be. And you say, what do you think, doc? And the doctor will tell you, here are the issues with that particular medication. And, there are also some pretty good places to go on online. There's a thing called WebMD, which I'm led to believe anyway is pretty reliable in terms of the information they have about various drugs and their side effects and all that sort of thing. So,
right. Or you could go to the Mayo Clinic's website or yeah. John Hopkins. So there are a lot of sources. But again, when people are desperate, and I think that level of desperation grows when, for example, a friend or a relative has passed away due to COVID-19, then
sure.
it's more immediate. And the more immediate it is, the higher the level of concern. Now, that's one of the scams. We see loads of them. In the last several weeks, we've seen the scams involving the government relief checks, where people have been receiving either phone calls or emails from the IRS saying, we can expedite your payment. All you have to do is, and usually all you have to do is, provide your social security number.
Mm-hmm.
There are people looking at wherever there's money. If there's money involved, there is likely going to be a scam that picks up on it. Now, another one we're seeing, charity scams. Whenever there's a major tragedy or a major event, charities start to pop up. And it happened in Vermont many years ago with Tropical Storm Irene. There were fake charities to help local people. The mm-hmm. ones we're seeing now with the charity scams are beneficial scams or beneficial causes to help out first responders. And they are generally scams unless you go to a reliable source. American Red Cross, United Way, local hospital.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about these charity scams, and obviously those kinds of things have existed for a long time. Is there a good place to go to kind of check, somebody calls up and says, I'm with the Vermont Association of blah, 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 and can I then get off the phone and go Google that or go to a website and get it to tell me whether that particular association is for real and maybe what percentage of the money they collect they actually put into the work they're claiming to do and so on and so forth?
Right. There are a couple of websites you can very quickly check. One of them is charitynavigator.org. Another one is give.org, which is the Better Business Bureau. So there are places you can go to. You can also go to the Vermont Attorney General's office, and you can contact them at their toll-free line, which is 800-649-2424, and ask them, because they track these scams. Something else you can do, if you get the call from somebody, you can ask them a couple questions. And usually the first question that I'll ask is, are you a paid fundraiser? Now, by law, if they are, they have to tell you they are.
Mm-hmm.
Second question is, what percentage of the money that you collect actually goes to the work of the charity? And we've seen other scams to benefit local firefighters, local police departments. Those are very traditional, where the actual amount of money that goes to the organization is something under 20% of the money collected. So you want to ask those questions, and you want to be informed before you donate.
Yeah, that's certainly before you write the check, before you give a credit card number. Social Security numbers need to be very carefully guarded. Isn't that true?
That's true, yeah. You can start a charity very easily. All you have to do is have an online account, create a website, and use some very slick graphics, and it can look very professional. So anybody can do that, which kind of democratizes the process, but it also makes it very easy for con artists who don't have to spend very much money in order to create an elaborate scam.
Listeners, I'm wondering who out there might have been targeted by a scam artist and have any stories they'd like to share about their experiences and how you figured out maybe that it was a scam and extricated yourself from the phone call or situation otherwise. Any stories like that, we'd love to hear them here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. The local number in Waterbury is 244-1777. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And by the way, while I'm making a sort of general announcement there, I also want to insert a programming note into our program here. And I mentioned that just after 11 o'clock, the 11 o'clock CBS News here on WDEV, we will once again be going live to one of the governor's news conferences, Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials, talking about the latest on the COVID-19 crisis and what state government is doing. Are we lifting any more economic restrictions? Are we finding any more results that are worrying or maybe relieving some worry, et cetera? They've been doing a great job in terms of keeping the public informed throughout. Typically, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in recent weeks, the governor and his people have been holding these news conferences, and WDEV has been carrying them live on our air. So stay tuned right after the Dave Graham Show today for another edition of those news conferences, and we will carry it live for you then. By the way, that means that Bill Sayre's Common Sense Radio program, it normally runs from 11 to 12, will not be airing today. All right, back to our conversation with Elliot Greenblatt of AARP Vermont. And Elliot, I'm wondering, do you sense that there is an easier time for scam artists to especially call people at home because more people are home picking up the phone?
Yeah, we've seen a lot more as far as the phone scams. They tend to run in cycles, but since probably late February, the number of phone call scams has grown dramatically. The problem that we have in tracking these things is, first of all, the collection of data is decentralized. People can contact the FBI at ic3.gov, the Federal Trade Commission, Vermont Attorney General's Office, Vermont Department of Financial Regulation. So the collection agencies are all over the place, and they don't commingle the data. The other issue is most people do not report scams. If they're not a victim, I caught that one. If they are a victim, people simply don't go around telling even their friends, guess what? I lost $5,000 in a scam yesterday. So underreporting and then this diffused collection system is what kind of stands in our way. So the result is that we have to get the word out to people as best we can. And in our program, AARP Fraud Watch Vermont, we do newspaper articles. We're a regular contributor to about 7 newspapers around the state, including newspapers in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, Claremont, New Hampshire, going all the way up to Newport, Brattleboro, Bennington. So we're coding the southern part of the state and up the Connecticut River Valley. Sadly, we don't have any outlets that we're contributing to in Chittenden County or Washington County.
Hmm. Well, listen up, publishers. Maybe there's another feature you can carry from these folks at Vermont Fraud Watch, AARP, and because this is important information to impart to the public. Hey, Elliot Greenblatt, I'm wondering, do you have any data or sense from others who are following this topic whether most scams come to people via telephone or are texts a thing, text-based scams, email, just messages on the web that people see and are attracted by, or is it mostly a telephone thing?
It's kind of a split between the phone calls and the emails, and mainly because they're both very inexpensive ways to reach out. You can use a Skype-like device, buy a call list, and simply call everybody on that list. And do it with a computer so you're not wasting your time as the scammer. You only have to deal with the positive responses. On emails, it's very easy to send out thousands and thousands of emails at literally no cost. So con artists aren't, people like to spend their money. And as a result, they like to use the method that gets the word out to the most people the quickest and at the lowest possible price. So they're no different than we are. We're always looking for a bargain, so are they.
Sure. Elliot, I wanted to ask about telephone etiquette strategy or whatever. What do you advise if somebody sees a strange phone number on their cell phone? I'm getting a call from, could be even within, a familiar sounding 802 exchange, but they don't recognize the number as a friend or a business associate or whatever. What should you do?
Well, the other issue with the phone call is that con artists are able to do what we call spoofing, and that is where they are able to replace the number that they're actually calling from with a local number. So, for example, I live in Brattleboro. Our local exchange is 254 or 257. So getting a phone call from 802-254, it looks like it's a local number. And, in fact, the con artists are able to get into phone records, find out your calling habits without too much difficulty, and then spoof one of the numbers that is on your call list, or spoof a local number that's recognizable, such as the local hospital. So it's very difficult to pick those up. If you see a number that you don't recognize, the easiest thing to do is don't answer. If you have an answering machine, let that phone call go to that machine. Typically, the con artists are not going to spend a lot of extra time recontacting you. So if they call you once and you don't answer, they're not likely to come back at you. They're likely to go on to other numbers. Remember, this is all computer-driven, so it's going to be an attempt to maximize their outreach, not to be able to go back to a call that wasn't answered.
So don't answer the call is one way to go. What about if you... Now, let's say you are, you consider yourself a legitimate person who's calling someone for a legitimate reason. And you're living in an age when nobody really wants to answer the phone on the first call like that because they think you might not be legitimate. And are there any ways to sort of get around that and to reconstitute the telephone as a fairly easy and straightforward way to communicate?
One way would, that I've used myself is I will send somebody an email and say, I'm going to be calling you at a particular time.
So,
make it a prior arrangement, either by you calling out or by exchange of email in order to say, this is when it's going to be safe. Call me then.
I suppose in that email, you might say, here's the number I'm calling you from also, right?
That's correct, yes.
I mean, it's just another little...
Protect yourself. And
yeah, another little layer of help there, I suppose, to give the person an indication they... Now they have the phone number, and if that number pops up on their cell phone, they can say, wait, was that the one in the email? And even check while it's ringing, I suppose, and decide then on the spot whether to answer the call or not. And I've actually taken up this technique a little bit, maybe slight modification, but I find myself, I often will text somebody and say who I am. I'm calling about perhaps having you be a guest on my radio program. Is now a good time to chat, or is there a better time later, whatever, and that often is the kind of icebreaker that helps. And because calling people just kind of out of the blue is becoming more difficult way to actually reach them. It's a slower process in many cases. And so you may as well just kind of send them something, an introductory basis before you make the call. I suppose, eventually the scammers will figure that out and they'll find a way to worm in even through those protections. But it's, this is kind of a constant cat and mouse game, isn't it?
One of the problems with, the technology is just that. It's technology.
Yeah.
And we have so many areas in the state of Vermont that are rural and don't have cell phone access. So people rely on landlines.
Yeah.
And leaving a text message now is not feasible. So there are communication hangups that we have, and trust me, the bad guys know what those are.
So yeah.
You try and outthink them. Now, I'll give you another example.
Elliot, unfortunately, we're about out of time. We've got to. Got to call it and head off to a CBS news break at the top of the hour. But we can get your next example next time. I hope to talk with you again in the near future about this topic, because it's a good thing to keep consumers aware of out there. And I'm always happy to get you on, on a monthly basis or something like that, and we can cover that. So thanks, Elliot Greenblatt of Vermont Fraud Watch and AARP, for joining me this morning. And we are going to go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple of words from our sponsors, and we'll be back shortly, folks. Stay with us.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program on this Monday morning, May the 11th, 2020. And glad to say we have one of our CBS News correspondents joining us for a few minutes this morning to talk to us about some of what's going on out there on the national scene, particularly in our nation's capital. And we have President Trump's top economic advisors are stressing the importance of states getting more businesses and offices to open during the pandemic. Their pitch comes as the coronavirus makes its way to the White House complex, where three members of the administration's task force are now in self-quarantine. Bill Rakoff is here to talk to us about some of this. And good morning, Bill. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Dave. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. And so I would say these are little bit of mixed messages coming out of the White House these days with kind of the facts on the ground and their own situation of the coronavirus getting awfully close to home, shall we say. Meanwhile, they're kind of saying we need to push past this and get the economy up and running again. What do we think about it? Is this going to work?
Well, I mean, I think the White House, if you take talk about the terms of having to deal with the COVID-19 virus, you had the vice president's communications or press secretary, I should say, Katie Miller, test positive for it. Of course, her husband is presidential advisor Stephen Miller. And then we heard of some others, a valet for the president who tested positive. Now, both the president and the vice president, we are being told, have tested repeatedly negative for the coronavirus. There was some talk that Pence would self-isolate, but that was quickly tamped down, saying that he would be back at the White House today. You talked about mixed messages, and there are some who feel that there seems to be a mixed message. While we're trying to tell everybody to stay home, and the likes of Fauci and Birx are doing that, self-isolating to an extent. You've got the president and the vice president who are going about saying, no, we don't think we need to do that. It's business as usual. But we can tell you that from sources inside the White House, there is a concern that now that the virus has made it through the gates and into the West Wing, they are going to try to do their best to keep it from spreading even more.
Do you think that the president and vice president will start wearing masks?
No, I don't think so, at least based on what they're saying. And what they've said is they're going by the best medical practices that they can be told by the White House physician and others, and they feel like they don't need to wear masks because they've repeatedly tested negative. And they say, remember, the purpose of the mask is to not have you spread the germs around. But we also know that not every single test is perfect, and that's another sign where people are saying, hey, you know, this is another case from the White House of do as I say, not as I do, particularly.
Well, I was going to say, in a typical office environment right now, let's say you work for any corporation in America, really, and you go to work and you have been exposed. Let's say someone who works in your household or something is very, very close to you has the coronavirus, as in the president's case, his own valet, and that person is now still going to work, who is not the person who has the coronavirus, but is the person who's been in very close contact with somebody with the coronavirus, that person would either be quarantined or, if still coming into work, would probably be required by his or her employer at least to wear a mask, no?
Yeah, you would think. And again, those are the guidances that are being given out. I can give you a personal example. A week ago on Sunday, I drove from D.C. out to Pittsburgh to see my dad and my brother, very quickly. And, you know, I had actually gone out to, on a really, real personal note, to see my mom's grave. She just passed away a couple of months ago, and it's the first I'd been able to get out there. Oh, that's all right. But I swung, but to the point, I swung by the house, and I said, hey, you want to visit a little bit? And my brother looks at me and says, yeah. He says, we'll set up chairs out on the lawn, and we'll sit 10 feet from each other. If you come in the house, he says, you have to wear a mask. And so, I mean, there it is. I mean, you know, so we're all doing the best that we possibly can. And, you know, the White House insists that they're following protocols as well. But there are others who, again, just feel like, you know, it's another case of mixed messages coming from the West Wing.
Yeah, that really is a I'm not saying this stuff is easy. I don't think anybody would tell you it's a fun thing to have to wear a mask to work. But I just you know, unless it's Halloween or something. But I sort of feel like that, well, anyway, that's, we can talk about leadership styles all day and that sort of thing. One of the things that I was curious about too, is I think you, have been, following the congressional activities on this stuff. And, Dr. Anthony Fauci looks like will be among a number of coronavirus task force members testifying on Capitol Hill. This is tomorrow, actually, Tuesday, before a Senate hearing on COVID-19, safely getting back to work and back to school. The CDC director and FDA commissioner also will testify. And, of course, this is all in, on the Senate side, right? It's not, they're not, the administration is not allowing these folks to appear on the House side.
Oh, that's right. And by the way, all the three you just mentioned are self-isolating right now because of the situation at the White House. So this is going to be done by teleconference tomorrow, and it will be done before Senator Lamar Alexander's Labor Committee. And he's self-isolating as well, by the way, because of some contact that one of his staffers tested positive. So you can see how this is impacting. But what the big rub is for Democrats in the House is they're saying, really? I mean, you're going to let these guys testify in front of the Republican-controlled Senate, but you won't let them testify before the House just because Democrats run it. You'll recall the president said, you know, called them haters in the House, the Democrats, and that's why he wouldn't do that. And it's got a lot of people up in arms. I talked with House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer last week, and he told me that he is considering the idea of going down the subpoena road like they did with impeachment. And I said specifically to him, I said, does that mean you would consider obstruction charges against the White House? And his one word response to me was, yep.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I don't know if it'll go that far, but it really shows you how it's getting under the skin of Democrats. They don't like it at all. They feel like they're being marginalized. And I mean, I think, you know, that's an accurate statement. You know, what can they do about it? Well, I mean, put up or shut up. They can do the subpoenas. They can pursue obstruction charges. But we, you know, I don't know that given the COVID thing that anybody's ready for another fight like that, like we had last year with impeachment.
Yeah, but I mean, let's just sort of think about the obstruction idea for a moment. And I usually think of obstruction of justice coming in the context of a separate criminal or, you know, related, but still separate criminal proceeding. So in other words, someone, you have an investigation going on of some allegedly criminal behavior and you are not cooperating. You're trying to block progress of the investigation, et cetera, and so they tack on an obstruction of justice charge. We don't really have an underlying criminal investigation here, do we?
No, I don't think so. You know, if anything, I mean, you know, the worst accusation that's being made against the administration right now is that they just bungled the response to this. But you do have oversight committees. And remember, this isn't a criminal charge. When you talk about obstruction of Congress and obstruction of justice, they're two separate things. So this was a lesson we learned in impeachment. When you're obstructing Congress, that just means you're not cooperating with them, and they don't need an underlying thing. If they ask for your cooperation, you don't provide it. And if they issue subpoenas and they're ignored, they have the ability, as you know, under the Constitution, to pursue these types of charges. Now, again, mm-hmm. you know, we're so weary of what happened last year. You know, I think the administration is counting on the fact that they've got the House over a barrel over this because, you know, they don't feel like anybody wants to go down that road, especially right now when we're trying to deal with the coronavirus. I mean, when you think about it, they've managed to pass four bills on a bipartisan basis. You start going down this road, any chance of any partisan cooperation on anything resembling relief is going to come to a screeching halt if it hasn't already.
Yeah, it's barely starting to show a pulse recently, and I guess this would end that any hopes of, you know, some sort of return to normal relations between the executive and legislative branches of government. So, I guess I see what you mean. On the other hand, I mean, I sometimes like to contrast what's going on now so we can sort of learn what it means with prior administrations. And are there any previous examples that you can think of where the House or Senate basically asked administration officials to come in and testify about what are we doing about X problem, wherein the administration said, well, we'll have them come in and testify in front of the body that is of our party, but not in front of the body that is controlled by the other party? Ever happened in prior administrations?
I can't remember of that specific example. I can remember, obviously, and it goes back, I think every administration at some point has, you know, resisted cooperating with Congress on one thing or another. But to my knowledge, and I would have to go back and look this up, but I don't recall anything, at least in recent history, where, you know, it was such a partisan move to say, we'll send our experts to the body that we think will treat us fairly, as opposed to the loyal opposition who we think will rake us over the coals. But in this day and age, I mean, you know, it really doesn't surprise that it's going to happen that way. You know, you just, there's just no, you know, this is the way that things are going in this, in this administration and the relationship with Congress. So it's just ratcheted up another level with this.
All right. Well, Bill Rakoff, I thank you very much for spending some time with us this morning. It's always good chatting with you. Let's do it again soon. Bill Rakoff from CBS News. Thanks a lot. You too. One of the things that we have noticed in the so many issues, as I've said previously on the show in recent days, have been kind of laid bare in the United States by this coronavirus crisis. You know, one of them, obviously, is our healthcare system. People have advocated for years trying to develop some kind of a universal healthcare system where everybody's in, everybody has some kind of health service and health coverage, et cetera, whether that's Medicare for All or some other system like that. We don't have that, and now we have a healthcare system which has really scrambled admirably in many cases, but not in any sort of centralized and organized way, really, to come up with the equipment that it needs and the ability to respond all across the country in a fairly uniform fashion to the coronavirus crisis. Another area that people have talked about for years, which has been highlighted by the coronavirus crisis, is broadband internet. We have had discussions in Vermont, for instance, about getting broadband service to rural corners of the state for probably a good 20 years now. And it still hasn't happened in 100% of places, and people are still working on it. But the issue of a lack of broadband has been pointed to in a rather stark way in recent months, as many of our public school kids are home trying to do their classes by computer. And meanwhile, we also have many, many more people working from home than had been the norm before the coronavirus crisis. So we will we'll have to muddle through here. But sometimes I wonder if Vermont had gotten serious 10 years ago or something and said, we really want to build out our internet broadband access statewide, as we sort of have. You know, there's some things which we do statewide. We do a road network that really reaches all corners of the state. We have public schools. A kid can live anywhere in Vermont and is required to have access to public education in the state. And so that's not true of necessarily of broadband internet, which now is considered a pretty key underpinning, at least at this time, for public education. So let's talk about that a little bit with a couple of people who have been working to bring broadband internet to rural parts of Vermont. Irv Tome is with EC Fiber, based over in the really in the sort of East Central. That's what EC stands for, part of Vermont, and they have served a number of communities. We'll find out exactly how many and have expanded some over the years. We'll sort of check in and see how EC Fiber doing. A little bit less far down that road, but I think aiming in pretty much the same direction, is something called Central Vermont Internet. Jeremy Hansen, who is on the Berlin Select Board, has also been involved pretty heavily with the CV internet effort, and we have both of these gentlemen on the line this morning. Jeremy and Irv, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And let me start with you, Jeremy, if I could. Refresh me now. It's CV internet, right?
So when we created the Communications Union District, that's the structure of our organization, like EC Fiber, we kind of incorporated during a town meeting vote under the name Central Vermont Internet, and then we'd later rebranded ourselves as CV Fiber, in the same style as EC Fiber.
Okay, so for sort of your banner or whatever, as a business, your DBA, doing business as CV Fiber now. Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
Okay, got it. And you are, what is your role with CV Fiber?
I'm the chair of the governing board. So because we're a communications union district, we're run in a similar way as any other municipality. We are a municipal public entity, required to kind of operate by all of the same rules that select boards and such are expected to. So I'm the chair. I'm the guy that puts out the agenda, kind of works with the delegates and alternates from our 18 member communities to kind of get things moving forward. And then behind the scenes, I also do a bit of other work with looking at our grants, putting together budgets, these sorts of things.
Okay. And Irv Tome of EC Fiber, also a communications union district. Is that right?
Yes, in fact, we were the first.
And you have how many towns now? How many communities are involved?
We have 23 active member communities.
23, okay.
River, west to the eastern slopes of the Green Mountains.
So tell me a little bit about what is a communications union district. I mean, I think we may have covered this some time ago on the show to some extent, but it's always good to have a refresher, and some listeners may be new to this whole idea. So walk us through that quickly, if you could, Irv Tome. I know this is also something that was a creature of legislation a few years back. So bring us up to date on how these communications union districts work.
It was a law passed in 2015. A communications union district is like other union districts, like for solid waste or water or even a union school district. Each member town sends a delegate to a governing board that sets policy. The way a communication union district is different, besides the obvious fact that its purpose is to build telecom infrastructure, is that it cannot be supported from local taxes. The law forbids that. A CUD can borrow against future revenue, but it is a municipal structure. In fact, in Vermont law, a union district is essentially a virtual town, a municipality. So as a municipality, a CUD can borrow in the municipal bond market in revenue bonding, and customer fees cover the debt service. They pay back the principal and pay the interest charges, as well as operating costs.
And, tell me about the economics of that, because, I mean, here's what has happened from my understanding and some coverage I've done over the years as a reporter, occasionally dipping into this topic. And one of the things we hear is that there are companies out there, private corporations, which provide internet service to folks. You think about Consolidated Communications and Verizon and AT&T. I mean, as a whole, sovereign. Yeah.
Make enough profit.
Yeah. But it's not, and they and they've profit. Said
they don't find it profitable to serve sparse populations on back roads in small towns.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's how we came into being. Actually, EC Fiber began as a voluntary association of people from 23 towns, way back in 2008. And we raised money. Well, that was just when the Great Recession began. And as that began to, we were not able to borrow money from the, or get money from the federal stimulus packages because we weren't already present on the ground. So, 2-3 years in, three people that wanted to demonstrate it could be done put up long-term loans at high interest, but no interest needed to be paid at the outset. And that let us get started. We built a demonstration project, and then people along the way said, how about us? And that's when we had the second great idea, and that was we offered the people the opportunity to invest, make loans, unsecured promissory notes in multiples of just $2,500. And over the next few years, we raised a total of, I think, $6 million that way. When the CUD statute passed, then we were able, by then we had built enough network and connected enough people that we had a track record. We were able to go out to the bond market, and we borrowed money on much longer term, lower interest basis. We were able to refinance all those short term, high interest loans and begin a more accelerated construction. And we have now more than 4,500 people connected. In I think it's 21 of our 23 towns at this point.
Okay, and have you found this economically viable? I mean, are you able to get the return you need to pay off your financing? And I don't know if anybody's taking a salary or return on investment.
The answer to that is an unequivocal yes. We are cash flow positive. We have been for several years now. We're doing very well. Let's see, how can I answer this? The bond requirements, the bond conditions require that we maintain a certain ratio of cash flow to the amount of debt service we have to pay back every year, and we're above that required margin.
Okay, so you're in good shape, it sounds like, basically.
We are in good shape. We are and we've proven that this model can work.
And Jeremy Hansen of CV Fiber, tell me, is your model pretty much the kind of the 2.0 version here? In other words, the 2015 Communications Union District, clearly the EC Fiber experiment was kind of being reshaped in its early years as time went on. It got a big reshaping and as that legislation passed in 2015. And I'm sort of thinking your story kind of starts then. Is that fair?
Yeah. So, I mean, like 2017, I think, is when sort of when it came to a head in Berlin. Some neighbors of mine, I was a teacher in Berlin, and we were talking one day, and she was talking about how she had moved into the community and was not able to deliver her coursework to her students because so many of the students didn't have good internet service at their homes. So this is after kind of several years of me at least thinking about it, and I thought this had to, we had to move forward. So we looked at EC Fiber and really appreciated, rather than this kind of market-driven approach, where there's seeking profit, the organization that's providing internet service is seeking profit, and moving to this community-driven approach, which is very it's bottom up, it's local governance, local accountability, and our mission is not to make a profit. Our mission is to serve internet to the people in our communities
at an affordable price. I'm thinking.
Yes, well,
but Jeremy, it's fascinating to me that, very early in this story was this teacher coming to you about her educational needs. And I want to talk about that and what's playing out now in the COVID-19 era. After the break, we got to go to a bottom of the hour break very shortly here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. We'll talk a little more about the educational needs of Vermonters and where those are being met and maybe not met as well, depending on access to internet. I think that the key impetus, or one of the key impetuses, if that's the plural of impetus, maybe impeti, who knows? But when the you start out with a push from an educator, basically. And so here we are really having a lot of pushes from a lot of different directions in education these days, given the COVID-19 crisis. But we'll talk about that. And also the working from home phenomenon that we've seen so much of in recent months also is heavily reliant on good internet access for folks. So let's talk more about that after the break. We're going to be coming up in about 30 seconds here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Just before we go to the break, I want to remind once again at the top of the hour, keep tuned right here to WDEV, because we're going to be going live to a news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials talking about the response to the COVID-19 crisis. We'll be back very shortly, folks. Stay with us.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Hey, we are back, and we are chatting with Irv Tomei, Jeremy Hansen. They are both leaders of their respective communications union districts, and the ones that run EC Fiber and CV Fiber. EC Fiber is a little more farther along down the road here. Jeremy Hansen of CV Fiber, tell me, are you guys actually running any fiber to people's homes yet? And are you are they getting signal, and are you up and running that one in that way, or is this still farther back on the planning stages?
Very soon. We have we're looking at a pilot project right now, and we were looking at having customers turned on by about quarter two of next year. So we have a feasibility study going. We know where some of the possible construction projects might be. We're kind of working out still some of the business details, but we're hoping to get our funding this summer and fall, start engineering by the end of the year, and then actually start doing construction next year. The wrench that went into the works here was, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, which is, like you mentioned earlier, really demonstrating how much we rely on internet service and also the digital divide. So how many people don't actually have, you know, reasonable access to internet service. So there's a lot of talk at the federal level and at the state level about how can we do this better. And we're in discussions with the state and the federal government about, you know, how do we can we provide internet service as part of a, you know, as part of the stimulus money that's come out, or is there another stimulus package of funds coming out? So we're looking at a couple different approaches, because we may have more funding than we thought we did, but our current plan that we, you know, without the pandemic we would have been pursuing anyways, as I said, about quarter two next year that we turn on the first customer.
Dave, I'd like to interject.
Yeah, Irv.
I mentioned that we got funded in a strange way. Last year's legislature passed Act 79, and that provides for VITA to make startup loans to CUDs and other community-based entities. That didn't exist when we were getting started. That that makes a that can make a big difference. But it still is daunting to find the funding to get off the ground. And Jeremy and we and leaders of other CUDs, newly formed CUDs around the state, are hopeful that maybe the COVID-19 crisis will prompt some more rapid attention and money to the startup point.
Yeah, that's that obviously I can imagine that being a hope for you. That would make a lot of sense. But I just want to wonder also. I mean, so there are some maybe an upside of potentially more funding available. Is there any worry, though, that I mean, I keep hearing just on the general economic front that we may be on the cusp or already in a depression, never mind a recession. And sometimes when the economy is shaking that badly, financing can dry up. Is that a concern?
Somewhat. We don't know what the bond it will look like in the next year or so. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this is clearly a huge economic emergency, and the federal government is moving with uncharacteristic speed, let's put it that way, to try to deal with some of the downside. We don't know how long people will need to work from home, whether it'll be another month or another year, but it's clear that to do it, everybody is going to need internet. Not just the people who live in the middles, more populated, more densely populated parts of towns, cities.
Yeah, one emailer, a listener actually sent an email earlier this morning asking for a definition of broadband, and I've seen one that's sort of an official standard from the federal government, from the Federal Communications Commission. And I wanted to talk with you gentlemen about that. Jeremy, do you recall what that is? The numbers, it's a certain number of megabits per second up, meaning you can upload stuff at a certain speed, and then another measure down, meaning you can that's where you get your movies and your other data that's coming down to your computer from the internet. So what are the current standards there?
Right. So As I understand it, the standard for modern broadband would be 25.3, so 25 megabits per second down. So that's from the internet to you.
Yep.
3 megabits per second from you to the internet. When you have a home office, for example, though, that 3 megabits per second really can be a big problem, can be a big bottleneck.
This is a pet peeve of mine and most of us involved in broadband, community broadband. The federal standard with a much higher speed for down than up is an emphasis on entertainment delivery, not economic activity. For economic activity, for working from home, for studying at home, for telemedicine, you need upload speed. The state, some years ago, set a goal of 100 in each direction by 2024. Dubious that the whole state will achieve that by that date, but that's the kind of speeds that are needed, and the fact that they aimed for symmetry, upload speed matching download, is extremely important. Fiber optic technology can go 10 times that fast in both directions.
And what about the volume of users on a network? That would be, I mean, assuming everybody had even five times that fast, assuming everybody had 500 up and 500 down, do you have the capacity on your system right now, Irv Tomei, and say the town of, I don't know, Royalton, to deliver service like that?
Actually, when our demand increases, we up our contract with the middle mile, with the long haul provider that is our connection to the rest of the internet. Yes,
mm-hmm.
That capacity.
Wow.
In fact, our individual customers can choose between four speeds. If they want more, if they want to move up to a higher price, higher speed level, they let us know. We don't have to go out to their house. We just make a change in the central office. And if they want to step down again, they can do that too.
That's interesting. I'm sort of imagining now a Vermont.
Now it's 700 in each direction. 800. I'm sorry, we changed that. It's 800. Since the first of this year, it's been 800 each direction.
What has been 800 in each direction?
All top speed.
Okay. Talk to me about prices. What's your standard package or your most popular package, and what's the speed and monthly charge for it?
Our basic speed is 25 in each direction.
25 in each direction.
That's $74 a month.
Okay.
72. We reduced that price in January.
Okay.
You step upward, I think, at 25 a month for each of the successive steps, which are now, I think, 100, 200, and then the 800. You know, I might have that middle one wrong, but that's the idea.
Okay, so let's just say you are a budding Vermont folk singer, and you're strumming your guitar and singing your heart out, and you want to make a YouTube video and upload that to the internet. Jeremy, do you have a sense of what kind of speed you need to do that?
Well, it depends on how long you want to wait. So, I mean, uploading YouTube videos, you can. I mean, if you have cable, if you have DSL, it can work. I mean, the reason I know that is because I have not great DSL where I am right now, and I'm a college professor, and I was uploading videos on my DSL connection here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, but I would have to wait hours, really.
Yeah.
So, I think it's much more interesting when you look at people who are live streaming. If you're live streaming at any sort of good resolution, then having cable may just barely get you there. If you're going to send out high definition performance of you strumming your guitar, you're going to want something more than 3 megabits per second out to the world.
Certainly more than 3. Yeah, would 25 do it?
If it was 25 symmetric, that would be better. Yes.
Hmm.
Now, if you're working remotely and you're connecting to resources at your office, if we're kind of getting away from just the streaming and just the media, but if I'm downloading files, I was sending class materials, gigabytes of class materials to some of my network security students, and again, so. Took forever. It would probably have been faster for me just to put it on a USB drive and literally drive it down to campus.
I mean, that obviously is kind of defeats the purpose of this whole thing. And Jeremy, I mean, you're an educator, obviously, of high in the higher ed realm. But I was talking with a couple of teachers on Friday, just asking them in general how it's going and so on in the COVID-19. Crisis. They were both elementary school teachers, so let's talk about for a moment our public schools and how they have basically moved online in the past couple of months since the shutdown order in mid-March that the governor issued. And are you hearing anything, either of you, Irv or Jeremy, about from your local teachers and school principals and superintendents and so on about a concern like, hey, we have a community over here. There are 48 kids living in this town, and this town has a dial-up or something, or poor or non-existent internet service. What are we going to do with these kids, et cetera? Any concerns coming to the two of you like that?
Well, I do hear that. I mean, less so around here. Berlin is okay. Coverage in 70% of houses, but sure. I mean, I have two kids who are in elementary school, so I asked the principal, what can we do for those students that don't have internet access? And for the most part, the school has been able to help them out and make sure that they have access, but. There's a lot of there's a map that the state has put up for Wi-Fi hotspots, which is is not a great option. I mean, do you want to do work in your car? Your kids want to do work in a car where they have some internet access? And I just want to go out on a limb here and say, as an educator, just because we can teach online, just because we are physically able to, doesn't mean it's necessarily a good idea. It doesn't mean it's necessarily right for our kids, but more so, not necessarily the right thing for our kids who don't have who don't have a fast connection. I mean, if my kids are on, you know, in a virtual classroom at the same time as I need to be on, I need to be on a call, or one of my other, my other kid is having downloading a YouTube video or watching something for school, that, we all have to still be home, and it just doesn't work with my super limited connection here.
What we've done in EC Fiber, and we did this immediately after the lockdown, we announced that we would connect any household that had a child that was eligible for free or reduced lunch and some other criterion, similar criterion, alternately. We would connect, if we already were present on the polls outside that house, we would connect that home for free and provide free service through the end of June. So that we're able to do that where we already are. And about half of our towns, we are fully built out and available on every road that has pole lines on it.
Irv, tell me, how many takers did you have on that? How many folks signed up for the free service?
I think it's only two or three dozen, actually. Might be.
Wow.
It's less than 50 people, certainly.
Huh. That's interesting.
Surprising. Obviously, it takes a while to get cable up on poles, and so we can only do this. We're not able to make that offer universally in our entire territory because there are some towns where we haven't finished build-out. But wherever we're already present, we've made that offer. About 2 weeks, a week or two after we announced that, I think the PUC then required all internet providers to provide service to households that need it wherever possible because of the schooling issue.
I meant to check this, but I thought I saw and I neglected to I confess before coming on the air here today, but I thought I saw a headline the other day indicating that one of the commercial carriers, I believe it was Comcast, had said it wanted to step up now and provide some expanded service in Vermont with this educational issue in mind. Do either of you know about that? Is that familiar to you?
I don't know much about it. I know that there's been an order in effect for some time now that the state has, the PUC has required Comcast to do another 300 miles of line extensions in various parts of the state, and I don't know any of the details.
Okay.
So I don't know if Comcast was announcing a new program or their intention to do what they've been ordered to do already anyway.
I see. Okay. So, of course, I may have to get somebody from Comcast on the air here in the coming days to find out exactly what the plans are and so on. And, because, again, this is a story that's been going on in Vermont for decades now, where the commercial carriers often take a look at the state and say there just isn't sufficient profit to be made when houses typically are it's two houses per mile of dirt road. And folks like living that rural setting, but one of the difficulties of that rural setting is that it is more costly for these companies, per customer, to string any kind of line, whether it's electrical or internet service, etc. So,
that is certainly true, and after all, that affects us too. But if you have two per mile in some parts of a town, you may have significantly more than that in the center of the town. We aim overall over our whole network. We aim to get to something like between five and six customers per mile. That would be averaged out over the entire territory. Because we've been building a lot of lines lately, and people are still coming online. Right now, we aren't at five per mile on the whole network. I think we're at 4.5.
I see. Okay, but obviously, you want to increase the number of customers per mile of line because again, this is a revenue issue, right?
It's it's an It is a revenue issue in order to meet the costs. That's right.
Yep.
And
yep.
And obviously, too, the rates that I quoted to you, those are higher than people would pay in a city for connectivity. That yep. is part of the fundamental economic reality, that we do have a sparser population. It's always going to cost somewhat more. On the other hand, at these prices, we're able to give the quality of service that you could get in the suburb of a large city. In fact, better than some suburbs of some cities.
Okay, so let me get down to the brass tacks then. Do you know, for instance, let's take what you are delivering in the Norwich, which is, I think that's where you live. Is that right, Irv?
Yeah.
Okay. Compare the service you're delivering in Norwich. Now shift the picture to New York City. Somebody's living in some part of New York City, and they have same level of service, basically the same speed up and down and so on. What are they paying per month instead of the $72? What are they?
I'm sorry to tell you, I don't know.
Okay, but it sounds like your belief is that it's something lower.
It's probably lower.
Yeah.
I don't know how much lower it is. And I think there are relatively few places, even in the cities, where you can get 700 or 800 megabits in both directions.
Yeah, that's pretty screaming speed. So if you get that, kudos to you. That's a big advantage. Irv, I wanted to shift ask you that educational question, though. Have you heard from teachers and superintendents? I asked this to Jeremy a couple minutes ago. Have you heard from teachers and superintendents, principals, et cetera, in your territory there, who have come to you in recent times and said, you know, I've got kids I can't serve because they don't have good internet?
I've heard that over many years. I haven't had people coming up saying that to me this spring, but I'm in the older at-risk population, so I've been staying at home and out of sight quite a lot.
You're right. Okay. That's right. They can't come up to you at least any closer than 6 feet.
No, so. Our daughter, the nurse, mandated my wife and I stay at home.
I hear you. And I know that's what a lot of people are doing in Vermont still these days, and probably will be for a while. We're all a bunch of hermits these days, and myself included. So this criticism, if it's a criticism, is in no small part directed at myself. But that's the deal. Hey, Jeremy Hansen, I'm wondering if you have a sense of that question I asked Irv about, I should ask you, do you have any knowledge of what you expect to charge for a standard internet access package for, say, a Berlin resident in 2021?
Given that we're using largely the EC fiber model, I'm pretty confident that we're going to follow roughly what they're talking about, what Irv's mentioning is the price. However, if we are able to get more grants, you know, stimulus funds, essentially cheaper capital to build the network, the prices will necessarily be lower. Because we really, I mean, the purpose of the subscription fee is, again, not to derive a profit, but essentially just to pay for the network, to pay for the things that have already been built, and to pay the operating expenses. So if we have less cost in terms of the network, of how much we pay for the network, then obviously we don't have to charge people as much.
It does make sense. Let me ask you, I'll start with you, Jeremy. The premise of this thing, the reason I wanted to have you two guys on today was to sort of ask you this final question, which is, are we ready to take from the COVID-19 experience the idea that universal access to high-speed internet and by broadband high-speed internet, I'm talking about at least the FCC definition, that 3 up and 25 down, is that something that now Vermont ought to regard as crucial as, you know, electricity, as crucial as public education, which is available to a kid no matter if the kid lives on a dirt road, 8 miles from the nearest neighbor in Norton or Canaan or something, still gets a public education. They still have roads up there, in fact. is this that crucial a piece of infrastructure now?
I think it always was that crucial of infrastructure. I just think that we are now, forced to take it seriously.
I would agree with Jeremy. I would point out the real recalcitrance is not within the state. The state's only problem is we don't have the money. The real block is at the federal level, where the Federal Communications Commission, under its current chair, Mr. Ajit Pai, refuses to acknowledge that Internet is a utility, an essential of modern life.
Yeah, I mean, that is a key way of thinking about it. And if you think about it as a utility, as an essential of modern life, then a lot of other things follow in terms of how it's regulated and how it is, how access to it is provided or guaranteed to folks.
Regulated at the present time because of an ideological presumption that the free market can do it better. The free market can do some things better, and there are other things that the free market will not do. And one of them is go into places where it can't make an adequate profit. But this is like rural electrification in the 1930s. And politicians often make that comparison, but they stop short of the kind of commitment that went with the concept of rural electrification back in the 1930s. And that was a federal commitment to make it happen.
Yeah, that is a that's an interesting frame and an interesting way of looking at this is whether we should and I think this idea of these community based small town efforts to just say, well, they're not giving it to us, we're going to get it for ourselves, spring up from that problem. Is that a fair way to describe it, Jeremy Hansen?
I think so. I mean, it's almost a shame, that we've had to sort of, stitch together these districts. There's five of these now. After EC Fiber sort of lit the match, EV Fiber, now there's one in the Kingdom, two in Southern Vermont.
Yep.
Because of, both at the federal level, but I think also a certain amount of political will at the state level, it's very easy to say, yes, everybody should have broadband. But then it's that political will to actually allocate the resources to actually get us there. And EC Fiber has shown that it can take some time, and they can do it without having.
I got to jump in here and tell you we're about the end of the show here. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for joining us this morning. Jeremy Hansen of CV Fiber and Irv Tomei of EC Fiber. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. That's about it for the Dave Graham Show today. Tune in again tomorrow. Stay tuned now for the Governor's News Conference. Have a great day, everybody.